Welcome to the Atomic Podcast. Whether you're a nurse anesthesia resident in CRNA school or an RN trying to get there, you're in the right place.
I'm Sachi, and along with Rhea, we're going to talk all things anesthesia and science, and we're going to bring along some of our friends too.
Join us each week as we dive into all things science and anesthesia. All right, welcome to another episode of the Atomic Anesthesia Podcast. Today we have a really awesome guest on our podcast, Dr. Gus Jessamaria. He is a friend, longtime friend, somebody that, how long have we known each other? 12.
Oh God. How long has it been for med school and
12, 13
residency.
Years. Yeah.
Yeah. Jesus. Yeah. Oh, Jesus.
So yeah. Actually, Gus and my husband went to medical school together back in, when did you guys start? Probably 2010, 2011. Mm-hmm. And you and my husband, Dave, became quick friends early on in school. We hung out a lot, spent a lot of time together. And also, Gus's wife is also a PhD scientist. So we just have these nerd out sessions all the time. So when last time we were together, we were talking about his job currently as an ER physician, and we thought that a great episode topic would be to talk about emergency airways in the ER and how that kind of differs from the OR. Talk about the emergency airway algorithm, the viewpoint from an ER physician compared to maybe the ASA difficult airway algorithm, and then just more generally how anesthesia providers and ER providers can really work more effectively together when trying to provide the best care for these types of patients. I know there's sometimes a little bit of tension in between the two departments, maybe not where you're at, but certainly in places that I've been at before. And I know others have experienced that as well. So before we get started, Gus, could you tell me a little bit about your background, your training background, and then a little bit about the practice environment that you're in right now?
Sure. I mean, the background's always a fun question, right? Because it's been, like you said, 13 years. But it's been quick. I went to residency over in Jersey in Cherry Hill. I did my medical school training there, and we rotated through three different hospitals, and it was a really great experience because we got a big mix of patients, a lot of sick folks in Stratford, a huge volume of patients at Washington Township, and a bit more of a higher end clientele over in Cherry Hill. So we got a really good mix of a lot of things, but one thing we really got a lot of was airways procedures. In my training program, I did the 5-year EMIM program because we knew that we were going to be in the hospital a lot. Mm-hmm. And doing a lot of procedures. So I was intubating people solo in my second year of residency, not knowing much about how to do much besides what my seniors, who may only be have been a year, you know, ahead of me, because paralytics weren't allowed.
Interesting.
So that's not an experience that a lot of young physicians will be getting anymore. And I remember distinctly docs that had been out for 30 years relating to me and my colleagues about that because it is something different. And now I'm up at Geisinger in Scranton through a small emergency group at their one hospital, GCMC. And it's amazing because I landed in a place where it became a hospital that had elements of everything that I was trained in, with volume, acuity, a lot of patients, and a lot of different types of reasons and scenarios for airways. So that's where we've had lots of different types of things that we can go over, and I'd love to speak about everything from procedural type stuff to the general feel and kind of how to get the best out of this job.
So a couple of things that you mentioned, and I don't know if people caught on to this. So Gus is actually dual board certified in two different specialties. Not only is he an ER physician, he's also an internal medicine physician. So it's a dual residency, dual board certified. And that's actually, I would say, on the rarer side. There aren't very many ER physicians that go through both residencies at the same time. So you do have that special training also in, you understand medicine really well on top of understanding.
And that's the thing, right? Like the job of medicine is always evolving. And I think that's just the one thing that I'd say, you know, we obviously are speaking about airways anesthesia, but doing the best you can to understand others, other folks' situations and their specialties and how they care for folks. It's really important, mm-hmm. which led to that decision.
I think that gives you a really good perspective also on how, like you said, how to work with colleagues outside of the ER department. I don't think a lot of ER physicians have that perspective. Maybe that's why they get a lot of, you know, slack sometimes. Anyway, so another thing that you mentioned that was super interesting is that you weren't allowed to use paralytics. Now, was that because you were a second year, or was that because that's just what they did in that ER?
No, if you weren't an attending physician, paralytics weren't allowed. So we would push usually etomidate and fentanyl and have at it. And it was all DL. There was no readily available, at least the first year or so, there was no readily available glide scope.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was, I feel very spoiled now with everything that I've got and a great team. Our hospital has 24-hour access to anesthesia. We've got glide scopes everywhere. That was fun.
You know, it's so interesting because glide scope is, at least the place that I practice at now, almost exclusively everyone intubates with the glide scope as the first thing that they grab. And I'm the only person there that still DLs patients. And the some of the attendings that I work with say, well, why do you still DL? Nobody else DLs anymore. I'm like, I'm afraid to lose that skill because not everywhere has got the fancy equipment. I realize it does, but you know, like you said, where you train, you didn't have all that fancy stuff. So you learned with some of these more you could call it rudimentary tools, but it really mm-hmm. was like basic stuff that every hospital is going to have. That's awesome.
If you lose a tool, you don't get it back. One of my colleagues, he has particularly large hands. He intubates. He's able to intubate using his fingers. So it depends on what you got. But just like you said, if you lose that DL skill and you got a nasty airway and you don't, the GlideScope camera ain't working, you're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Bloody airway. I'm sure you have a lot of that too. So absolutely. Speaking of airways and intubations, let's just jump right into it. So what are the types of patients that you end up intubating in your ER?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing. I mean, you can go over we have peds, obviously adults. We've got elderly folks, folks with all kinds of different pathology, angioedema. But there's a lot of intubations in the emergency room that aren't necessarily due to the patient that can't breathe. There's some that are on polysubstances that have multiple electrolyte abnormalities or something like that. That really makes it sketchy, but they're not having trouble breathing, but they also have a high chance that they're going to lose their airway for X, Y, and Z reason. Or they're so combative and they need so many medications to keep them calm. We've had a lot of methamphetamine, which has just been getting crazy nowadays. And that's, you know, these patients, you could give them 30, 40 milligrams, sometimes a Haldol, they're not going down, 10 of Ativan. And now you don't know if they're just going to suddenly stop breathing. So, I mean, we got a lot of agitated combative patients too. So there's quite a lot of patients that you'd never really see in the OR for intubation and the ER that have their own challenges with their approach to intubation.
Absolutely. You know, when I was working level one trauma at Cooper Medical Center, that's a hospital in a level one trauma center in Camden, New Jersey. Some of the traumas that came in, they just couldn't assess the patient and couldn't take care of them. So sometimes they're just like, tube them because I can't even do a proper ATLS assessment on them. So that happens as well. Do you think
explaining that to patients, families is very difficult?
Yeah, absolutely. For the types of airways that you do, do you feel like they are, and I'm sure that you did a couple in the OR too, right? Did you do an OR rotation? So you kind of
Yeah, we did. I think I did maybe 2 weeks of anesthesia.
Okay. So at least you have seen like how anesthesia intubates in a very controlled setting.
Very.
Yeah. Where everything's like, you got all your perfect equipment set up and all the drugs and the patient's healthy, pretty much. But for your intubations in the ER, would you say that they are a little bit more controlled, or would you say that they're a little bit more like, I don't want to say chaotic, but true emergencies?
So, and that's the tough part, right? So like the true emergencies versus the controlled, I would say that if you're intubated in the ER, it's depending on your perspective, it's never a controlled situation as compared to the OR. The OR is your idealistic, hopefully, situation where the patient's been MPO, they've been prepped, consented, they've gotten every step along the way. Almost invariably, just by being an ER patient, you're going to have less resources. Even in a trauma bay, potentially there's less that there is readily available to you. So it's tough. But I'd say as far as like true serious emergencies that need to be intubated immediately, or God forbid, which we obviously will talk about, a surgical airway, there's not as many as you'd think. The chaos really generally comes from the fact that almost any patient in that ER can somehow flip on a dime, start vomiting uncontrollably, start losing their pulses, and then all of a sudden, an intubation has to come out of nowhere. And I have had folks be very concerned because they don't know, oh, well, where's my backup? Where's my third backup? Where's my bougie? You know, like sometimes things happen so quick, you don't actually have time for that stuff, unless you've got it in your back pocket, or unless you're like yourself, you got a DL in, you know, close at hand, where you can get in there and do things quick. So that's always a tough question to answer.
What type of patient would you say, if you heard this diagnosis or if you saw this type of patient, you would think to yourself, oof, that's going to be a tough one?
Epiglottitis.
Can you explain what epiglottitis is for the audience, sure, in case they don't know?
Absolutely. The epiglottitis is just your glottis, your throat, your anatomy, so to speak, basically has a very thin membrane that is acting like a ball valve that stops you from, you know, breathing into your stomach every time you take a deep breath. And sometimes you get an infection right there, and it becomes so narrow around your vocal cords that it becomes a challenge to breathe for somebody, so to speak. And epiglottitis usually develops pretty insidiously. A most recent one that I'd had, the lady actually was very calm considering the situation, but had been dealing with symptoms for over a week and a half. She did have stridor on exam, but because she was extremely calm and breathing very slow, very smooth, you got to realize you're breathing through sometimes the diameter of a small straw, if not thinner. So you can imagine how panic inducing that can be to somebody. And if she were to panic, she probably would have died, because she didn't actually get diagnosed with epiglottitis until one of my astute PAs had come over and said, hey, I got this lady in the back that, you know, she says something's not feeling right in her throat. And sure enough, when we, assess her, she had an airway that was maybe half a centimeter open. And those kind of diagnoses, additionally angioedema, you'll have a patient come in at 4 a.m. all of a sudden, my tongue is swollen, and they'll literally have what looks like half of their fist sticking out of their mouth. And, then you got to start thinking about, geez, how do I get this person to get an awake intubation? Mm-hmm. 'Cause those are fun. And those kinds of diagnoses, when I hear them, that's like, if we're talking about controlled or not, it's controlled if I know about them ahead of time in any capacity. That's when where I'm at right now. Luckily, I can get the anesthesia team. I can get folks with me that will help. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is, it's if that airway sounds, vomits, we almost always assume everyone's going to be vomiting in the ER. That's just the nature of airways in the ER. So that one doesn't scare me as much as it used to, but yeah, it's the narrow airway, the mechanically blocked or obstructed airway that may or may not need some mechanical intervention that does make me nervous. We had a child that had was playing with, because kids do these things, playing with a pile of tools or screws or something like that. It was complicated the situation even further. His family and the patient spoke Spanish, and this kid, well, I couldn't really speak much. He was only two, but basically, through the delays of using a translator line, it was found that the patient may have, you know, came in almost thinking maybe bronchiolitis, you know, they've got some airway involvement and stuff. But the thing that made us nervous, that the airway that I was saying is, you know, they really didn't, you know, respond to any racemic epinephrine or anything. And that's always what I was in the back of my mind. I was always taught, you got to think about what if the kid swallowed something? What if something went in the airway? And sure enough, this was one of those things where why anesthesia and ER may have some friction, because this child had no imaging. They had just come in and they sounded like a bronchiolitis. You can imagine me calling up the attending anesthesiologist, who was let's say a bit grumpy because he was getting awoken for a child that may have bronchiolitis, but that I'm worried that there might be something in their airway. And so he comes down, he's a bit upset, and sure enough, we finally get the kid sedated and under, and we look, and there is the small wall anchors, the gray ones that you put in when you're not using a stud, when you're trying to hammer something into the wall.
Oh my God, that like plastic piece?
Lodged right between the kid's vocal cords. And
stop.
We had a team effort of me using a small hemostat and him holding the GlideScope, which thank God for GlideScopes, I'll say at this point, and pulling that sucker out of there.
Wow.
So actually in those situations, the more nervous thing that I would say in those kind of airways is not being able to get a specialist to buy in, because that's really the key, is getting a specialist to help with somebody, because it is tough sometimes.
I think one of my worst ER airway experiences is Christmas morning. I remember I'm at this point probably 7 months pregnant. ER calls me to be on standby. That's I think that anesthesia gets annoyed by that. I don't know why. We just don't like being on standby. We like being like a part of the decision making process. We don't like being like the rescuers. So, you know, be on standby, angioedema patient, also big muscular guy, end stage renal disease. So not able to get the succinylcholine, not sure what the potassium is, needs to be intubated. And their plan was, we're going to simply put him to sleep and use a GlideScope. And you can imagine how that went. You know, we can go into more of the story details later, but anyway, I think that dynamic between anesthesia and ER is always so interesting, because sometimes you don't really have time to come up with like a, hey, let's sit down and chat and come up with this like awesome plan. You know, you're like having to make pretty quick decisions and not cause a lot of drama and fighting, but also take good care of patients. So the patient ultimately did get intubated after about an hour of lots of multiple attempts. But yeah, that was a tough one, I remember. So anyway, so as we're starting to talk about, let's talk a little bit about controlled intubation. So, and I do say air quotes controlled. So say like you're setting a patient up for an intubation. You're not crashing onto intubation. You have like maybe 5 minutes to get some stuff together. What are some like equipment that you're like, I always make sure I have X, Y, and Z? What are some ways that you kind of like set up that patient so you are successful or the most successful during this intubation?
Absolutely. I mean, the first, I guess, approach step before there's even steps to be considered is, as far as ER medicine goes, the maximization of the first pass attempt, that's got to be your paramount thing. You really want that first attempt to be successful. So you will have a backup if you have the time, thank God. You know, in this case, if we've got 5 minutes, which is a blessing, really the first things we're setting up obviously are tubes. So depending on what you think the age of the patient is or what their airway is going to be, and if they're in front of you or not, maybe half a size smaller. So maybe like an 8 and a 7.5, 7.5 and a 7, kind of depends on the situation. I do glide as my first attempt almost always, unless I need to get a little practice on my DL, because obviously that has the most literature and science-based evidence that it does actually have better first pass effect. We're often creatures of habit, which is a good thing sometimes, and other times it's sometimes a bad thing. But that is the nature of the game, is that if you've got a patient that you have the glory of being able to figure out something in 5 minutes before they come in, stick to the thing that's going to take the least amount of time. And if the GlideScope is statistically going to be your best bet as a first attempt, you got to go with that first in most kind of situations. Then it's the simple basic stuff otherwise, right? We're always going to have our AMBU bag. You're always going to have your suction set up. Medications. Luckily, we at our facility have a pharmacist. I tend, like I said, to keep things as quick as possible. I tend to favor rocuronium over succinylcholine As far as paralytics go, because of that question of potassium, just as you'd mentioned, is that if I've got to make a decision on intubating this patient and there's not a known history of kidney disease, or maybe they went into cardiac arrest, and obviously if their H's and T's suggest maybe hyperkalemia was a potential cause, that would really stink if that comes out later, and that doesn't help much. So that's why I'd usually have rocuronium with etomidate as well, ready to go. I also, as a key step in this process, I don't necessarily agonize over the dosages. A lot of folks obviously want to stick to the very regimented dosages, but if you're doing math in your head while someone's coming in crashing and with an airway, round to the nearest 10, likely upwards, especially with your sedative, and go from there. Basics of that being set up, where obviously once the patient gets in, going to make sure that they're on the monitor. Finally, we have end-tidal CO2. I know that sounds archaic, but it's true. Most ERs do not use or don't have access to, for whatever reason, continuous CO2 monitoring, even though it's quite literally the standard of care. We still have a lot of cases where, you know, or we used to have a lot of cases, which it was still just color capnography, you know, at the end after you intubate them to see and make sure they're not in the stomach. But that's, you know, that's a new thing now. And in general, you make your attempt, whatever the issue may be with the airway, that's when you'd maybe go to your backup. I always myself have a backup of a DL. The reason, and I've had anesthesiologists that I've trained under question this validly, of using a MAC-4 as your blade of choice. And that was always the classic ER. I always used the MAC-4. And the reason that I tended to favor it is that if I have whatever difficulty with the patient, maybe they've got something going on with their epiglottis, as we'd mentioned earlier, maybe I can throw it in a little further and turn it into a Miller and not have to change blades. And that has happened on a few attempts at terrible airways where you can go all the way past your target and start to slowly pull back and just push the whole anterior airway forward. Those would be the basic steps of a kind of controlled airway, but that's the key, is sticking to things that are going to give me the least amount of manipulation, first pass success being the highest, and hoping for the best.
I agree with you with the MAC-4 thing, because you can,
we got to start a group.
You can, it is versatile when you don't want to do multiple attempts. I know that in the ER also, you tend to, do you do the nasal cannula thing? You do the cannula thing. So really big on oxygenation.
Absolutely. Scott Weingart, he always used to tell us, he always used to say, you got to put O's through the nose. That's how he used to describe it. And it was, it's, you know, you can build up quite a lot of CO2, as you may be aware. And some of our COPD patients have numbers you've never even thought of that are survivable, but oxygen you really can't do without. So if you've got a chance to fill every area of dead space in that upper oropharynx, nasopharynx, upper portion of the trachea with oxygen, you're going to have at least a few more seconds of good time to get that airway, whatever the problem may be, that's likely life-saving potentially. So absolutely. Hell, throw a friggin' nasal cannula anywhere you can. I don't know if the ear will help much, but you know, you put it in there, see if they can. And that's the other thing too. This is not like a scientific, oh, how many liters of nasal cannula? Just crank it. Like, you want that to basically be like a high flow at that point, because you got to be getting a little bit of pressure to push that oxygen into there so that they're filling up everything, getting all the nitrogen out. So definitely highly recommend that.
Yeah, and for those who are not familiar with pre-oxygenation as a step before intubation, and what we've always learned in anesthesia is that if you properly pre-oxygenate patients and you get them over 90% oxygen in their airways, the patient can be apneic for an upwards of almost 8 to 10 minutes without desaturation. So that pre-oxygenation is super important, and even more important in the emergency room where the patients are really sick.
Well, the other thing too that really matters in that, and we'll get into it more, but yourself, obviously, as the person performing the intubation, always has to realize your pulse ox that you're reading on that person's finger in those cases is about 2 minutes behind. Yep. So by the time you see that desat, they've been desatted for 2 minutes, mm-hmm. and they ain't coming back for 2 minutes. So even when you like, it's better to pre-oxygenate. Oh, they're 98, 99, 100. Let me intubate. No. Keep oxygenating them. If you've got the time, give them another minute. Give them 2 minutes of just straight up oxygen and fill up all that area so that everybody, you know, everything gets filled. And make sure staff knows too, because a lot of folks that are going to start freaking out at bedside because they think that you may not know that the patient is desatting if that is starting the way things go, and you've gotten the airway, and oh doc, you know, you said you had the airway, but they're still desatting. Make sure you just, you know, calmly inform, listen, so we're just going to keep, you know, bagging, we've got good CO2 on our capnography, and it's going to take a couple minutes before the pulse ox pops up, and then it pops up, and then you look like everything's great. So yeah, definitely make sure that you're oxygenating really well.
I think one thing that a lot of people, clinicians, when they're starting out, have a hard time grasping is that there is a difference between ventilation and oxygenation, that there are two separate concepts. And even some providers that are seemingly experienced, you know, still kind of obsess over the oxygen saturation, but have paid no mind to ventilation. You know, it's like, it's fine, guys, we're ventilating. it'll catch up. But of course, a lot of the airways that you do are emergencies, and they don't always go as planned or smoothly by, you know, first pass getting the tube in. And so you have to start thinking about some kind of emergency airway algorithm. Certainly in the ER, you are trained very heavily in this, and anesthesia as well. What we use is the ASA, which is, for those who don't know, that's the American Society of Anesthesiology. ASA has a difficult airway algorithm. They just published their updated version in 2022. Made a couple subtle changes here and there. But I'm curious to hear how the ER performs their emergency airway algorithm. If you can kind of go through it step by step, how you would do this for your patients, your patient population.
Sure. I mean, obviously airway needs its own little planning session, but it really is it's been the same as far as I'm aware since 2009, with MCRIT that has kind of rehashed this. And MCRIT's probably based on obviously resources that you're saying, but in general, first thing is let's say have a patient that's been paralyzed. You've made your first attempt and now you failed. Like we talked about earlier, then maybe you grab your smaller tube, a DL instead, if it was a GlideScope originally, depending on what your secondary plan is, maybe plus or minus a bougie. You're going to give that attempt as number two. And then if that does not work out right, now this is the part where you got to really realize, are we ventilating? Are we oxygenating or neither? And that's where you're going to start to have the split point where you have to really decide. If you're going to make that third attempt, it's assuming at that point you must at least be oxygenating, as we talked about. If you don't have oxygen at that point, the patient's most likely going to be in cardiac arrest if that's the case. So on that third attempt, if you're not really working out, you can. I've personally never gone this route. Unfortunately, I end up going to the surgical airway because it's just not, depending on what the reason is, I guess, but you can consider a supraglottic airway, but you're not really protecting the airway necessarily that way. If you can get oxygenation that way, then try, do at least 3 minutes of supraglottic airway if you can get an airway with oxygenation there, but you're still going to need to get into that patient intubated. So you can try to intubate through the subglottic airway, which I've seen. We do actually at our facility have disposable bronchoscopies that are attached to our big GlideScope machine that you can load a ET tube onto and actually do a video laryngoscopy. But I've only had to do that once, and that was not a third attempt or fourth attempt at an airway. That was just a precaution of an airway that was thought to be difficult that could have gone that way. So that's, you know, if all else fails, you're not getting adequate airway, you're failing to oxygenate at any point and ventilate at the same time, you got to be thinking surgical.
We actually go to the LMA quite often as a rescue device. I've only personally had to do that once. I had a patient that was down and I think we were doing a procedure in the CT scanner. We were doing some kind of ablation procedure. The guy was really, really morbidly obese. He was probably on upwards of 400, 500 pounds. Of course, it's never an easy patient, right? It's always and prone case, prone MAC case. And we had to, could not intubate, could not ventilate. No glide scope available. And all we had was the crash cart and LMAs. And that's ultimately what saved the guy. And for me personally, I've never done a surgical airway outside of a simulation environment, but you certainly have. What is that? What is that like doing surgical airways? And what type of surgical airways do you do?
Craig, we'll go for the Craig is what we do here. So I think looking back, you know, it wasn't my airway on this first time that I've ever seen one done. It was actually one of my co-residents that actually did a surgical airway in his third year. It was absolutely indicated in this particular case. But he had gotten into trouble, even though he'd saved the patient's life, because everybody at the bedside was freaked out beyond belief, like literally like screaming and like, oh my God, what are you doing?
Oh my God, really?
Yes. And this was a patient that was on the floor. Their airway had just completely collapsed. So this was, and he was actually one of my EMIM. He was actually a year, behind me and had done this. And I was like, badass, we got good people in this program. Anyway, so he had done this airway. So the thing about it that you really, I think, in hindsight and of myself doing these from then, is your team has to be very much mentally prepared, and you've got to be the one to prepare them on the routine, almost on every airway, if you can do it. If you talk with your team, if you have any of that 5 minutes, like we talked about earlier on that, you say, listen, guys, this patient might need a surgical airway. There will be blood. Let them know this is going to be very bloody. Unfortunately, unlike the training simulations, surgical airways are very much obscured. You will not see exactly where you're going. So you have to find your correct spot. You have to do your incision side to side and then place your airway, whether it's from a kit, not personally my preference, but a small ET tube, whatever it is that you have as your surgical airway, but making sure that your team knows like, hey guys, this is the plan. If things go this way, can be that warning with blood. You could also tell your team on routine airways. And this is the one that's more like you have to do it over and over again to a point of it being like another step in your airway. Is I used to have an attending that every single person that got intubated or was being assessed for an airway would mark with a surgical marker on their neck. So and it was never had to see a surgical airway from this attending ever, but in front of everybody before intubation attempts even went, would put that small mark right on their neck, right where there would be the correct spot. And looking back, I'm saying that's very smart because you're in a way either consciously or subconsciously getting everybody in the room aware that if this goes the wrong way, I'm going to be cutting this person's neck right here and there will be blood.
Huh. That's brilliant, actually.
And so that is a big step. That is often missed. The bottom line is the surgical airway, as intimidating as it is, it mechanistically, when you really break it down, it's not as difficult of a procedure as you'd think. But managing the shock and awe and the chaos of it, that's where your job really needs to be focused if you really needed to break it down.
Sounds like you really being a leader in that environment and a lot of coaching before it happens, knowing that it could be a possibility. Now, you're talking about cricothyrotomy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So cricothyrotomy, for those who are maybe not completely aware of the landmarks for it, can you talk about the landmarks of how you find the cricothyroid membrane?
Well, so you're not going to go for the Adam's apple. I feel like that's where everybody starts.
Mm-hmm.
I would want you to actually start from the very bottom. You'll feel those first two rings well below your Adam's apple, and that's your little diamond, it's technically diamond-shaped box. And you're going to pop your, if you got an 11 blade, ideally, right in there, a gentle side to side, blood everywhere, so you're not feeling anything. I'm personally a fan of the Sellinger technique for most procedures if possible. So I usually actually have a wire where I would place so that I've got airway, and then throwing something over there, a dilator and something in there. Usually I use in like a 2-0, 3-0 ET tube, something along that line, just to sneak something in there. But there are kits. If you do speak with folks that are, if you're lucky enough to be a trauma center, we are a level 2 trauma center. We're on that. So we do have these kits with the plastic curve to them. They work. They definitely are, they do their job, but anything goes when that happens. But yeah, don't start from the top. You start from the very bottom. You start feeling those. And everybody's going to have it. Even if you're really large, you just got to mentally prepare yourself that you're going to have to, you know, go a little deeper. Mm-hmm, hopefully you never mm-hmm. have to go for more than one of these, right? But, you know, you don't usually build up a ton of adipoids right over that area. So
do you ever do a slash trach?
No. Slash trach?
Yeah.
Cut across? Do you just go vertical? Because I have seen
ones. Dave is my husband, Dave. He's an ENT. So he says to do a slash trach, you just cut a large vertical incision.
Yeah.
And he's like, and it's going to bleed like stink. And yep. you just large, and you just take some forceps and spread. So you get the trachea and just shove an ET tube in there.
Yep, that makes sense. Because, I mean, that's what we would say is that if you can't find it, you just extend vertically. Just keep extending vertically. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I'm going to call it a slash trach because that sounds way cooler.
I don't know. I've always heard it that way, slash trach. Yeah, large vertical. Anyway, so now we've gone through the emergency airway algorithm. But, you know, every now and then the ER does try to extend an olive branch out and call for the anesthesia team to come down and perhaps help with the airway, sometimes ahead of time to say, hey, we have a dicey airway. We might need you as quote unquote backup. But sometimes in the event of holy smokes, we cannot get this airway. We need a second set of hands. Can you guys come down? How is that relationship for you guys? And how does that normally go for you?
So when we call someone to the ER, this is the true nature of it, we're supposed to be consulting somebody for a reason. And I've had times where I've discussed an airway with an attending physician and maybe even had them and them helping with something. To them actually being the one performing it. The dynamic where I'm at is actually very much relatively good, save one or two different, you know, situations depending on just the pressure of the cases. A lot of times, especially really young, like I've had neonatal airways, those can get a little, let's just say charged. And that would, I would argue, be a situation for almost any specialist and, you know, attending or whomever, just due to the pressure of the situation. So it's not bad. But the fact of the matter is that the ER doctor does have the responsibility of knowing why they're calling that person. And I've had, like I said, with epiglottitis, that young lady that was very much calm, and I could get to an operating room without much hassle because she was relatively calm. I was even able to explain things to her, and she was able to still continue to breathe effectively. In that case, I'm calling anesthesia, bring this young lady to the OR and do it there. Okay. Mm-hmm. Done. I've had others where, I do need backup because, this lady or man is 500 pounds and, they're crashing, and frankly, I could use somebody up at the airway or somebody to put a line in, because guess what? Anesthesia is actually pretty good at doing other procedures for vascular access and such too. So the nature of why you're calling is extremely important, and I've noticed a lot of the frustration, at least from the ER docs, noticing what upsets the anesthesiologist is the ER doc not knowing that of what they're calling them for, which, you know, there's a lot of different things with that to do with, you know, experience and, you know, maybe not knowing exactly what you need from that specialist, but that part I've seen. So one way to mitigate it, at least from the ER side, looking across the bend, would be, to know why you're calling mm-hmm. and what to expect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think, and skipping ahead for just a second, do you think that there, I think people are always afraid, this conversation comes up a lot, when you get called to be backup, when anesthesia gets called to be backup. I think a lot of people somehow come to this conclusion in their mind that there could be like medical legal issues with that. Have you ever come across that, or is that something that you guys ever discuss?
That's interesting. Not particularly, but I can see where someone could be upset about that. I can see where you've called someone to be back up and then the airway is a failure, the patient dies, and now, you know, someone documents the name of somebody on their chart when all you were was quote unquote backup. And that, mm-hmm. that is frustrating. Because obviously in the medical legal world, everybody who's anybody gets named, and, you know, it can be very, very hard on the practitioner, I'm sure, for that. And that's the idea, is I can definitely empathize with that feeling. But it hasn't come up as a specific reason that someone's upset. Usually it's getting woken up or something and not being able to do anything, which is yeah. the typical part of things. But just speaking on the medical legal issues, I mean, again, another Scott Weingart ad is saying, so to speak, would be intubation is a license to kill.
Hmm.
If you screw up that airway, you very frequently, well, the patient was very sick and, oh, you know, things went south and, oh, they desatted and they went into cardiac arrest. Oh, we're sorry for your loss. And it could have been that extra oxygenation that would have saved that patient's life, but now they're dead. It could have been that extra jaw thrust and maybe having a specialist that has a better idea of how to do things in a certain way that could have saved that patient's life. So the medical legal part of it really isn't the case. The real thing that'll keep you up at night is whether or not when you have that failed airway, is there something that you could have done better?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the thing I think that folks don't realize. They think that if they're, you know, if the airway is a crash, if the airway crashes, it's almost like an airplane crash, right? Like, I don't want them to die because of this airway. But the reality is, you know, there's going to be patients, unfortunately, that are dying or having bad outcomes pretty much no matter what you do. Just like yep. people that are on the road that have car accidents and fender benders, technically, you know, being in the airplane is safer. So even if airplanes are analogous to doing airways and, you know, your automobile car accidents or your average patient, bad stuff's going to happen. The most important thing, if you're worried about medical legal stuff, is making sure that you're communicating. You got that patient that needs an airway and they can understand you, talking to them like a human being, saying why you need to do it, talking to family. Why do they need to be intubated? What do you mean putting them on a machine? Isn't that bad? I see that in the movies, and going through that. That's how you protect yourself medical legally. So that's where I stand on those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a good analogy. Why, and to just like tie up this, you know, anesthesia ER thing, why, in your opinion, do you think that there is tension between the two specialties? And you kind of alluded to this a little bit about, you know, communication and between the two specialties and really understanding why that, you know, the anesthesia team is being consulted. Are there any other you know, insights that you might have as to why there might be tension between the specialties? Do you get a sense?
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the name of the complex that ER docs can get.
just ER docs?
Well, we're the young guys. I mean, if ER was formed as far as like a specialty, quote unquote, in 1979, you know, that means that anesthesia's got at least, you know, four decades, if not more. CRNAs have been probably even longer than that. The fact of the matter is you're the young specialty. I have docs that are maybe a decade or two out from me that remember a time when it was actually at our hospital, a time where anesthesia was vehemently against ER docs having the ability to use paralytics.
Hmm.
Because the argument was these young ER docs, this specialty, is they're just going to kill patients left and right. We used to not be able to interpret EKGs. We start winning these battles, you know, objectively, because no one wants to be the cardiologist at 2 a.m. reading EKGs.
Mm-hmm.
Let the ER
mm-hmm.
do it. Let the ER docs use paralytics so that we don't have to be there for every single intubation of, you know, any nature, you know, and so that, that part gives us both pride and a bit of an inferiority complex, I think, where we try to have some kind of autonomy. We're now the ER doc. This is our domain. And we've called upon anesthesia to come to our house. And now anesthesia comes down, and it's not clear to the team, each of the attendings in this case, or whomever is down to help from anesthesia, who's in charge, who's the one making the decisions ultimately. Right. Somebody's got to be the leader. But the ER doc may think, well, I'm the leader. It's my ER. Where's the anesthesia? Well, you called me, and I'm the guy with the airway stuff.
Right,
so
exactly.
The friction can be a simple misunderstanding of who is leading. So oftentimes, if you've called, again, the key really step one is knowing why you've called this person to your emergency room. If it's to get the airway, they're up at the head of the bed. And in general, the position of who's calling shots, as far as overall general patient care, you're at the foot of the bed. You're usually out of the way there. And that's the position that usually most folks around this critically ill patient can hear you. So simple things of positioning around the patient, getting buy-in from everybody that's around. And like we talked about earlier, prepping the team in whatever way is possible. Those are the keys. And friction occurs when that's not clear, when there's unnecessary noise, when nobody knows what anybody's doing, when you don't have buy-in, when you've called that attending down or whomever it is down, and they don't know why they're there, and you don't know why they're there necessarily, or at least you put off the aura that you don't know why they're there. They're going to be pretty pissed that they're woken up at, 3 a.m. for something that, could have been quote unquote handled by the ER doc. So it's really more of a foresight into what's going to occur kind of thing.
Right, right. One thing that you mentioned that is critically important, I think that I should state again, is that the person who is leading this situation needs to stand at the foot of the bed. That is a very, very common leadership position, especially in trauma medicine, emergency medicine, is that the person that is leading needs to not be involved in some kind of task. They need to have an overview of the team. Every member needs to be assigned to a task, but the person that's leading cannot be involved in a task. So for you to try to lead and intubate and do all of these things at the same time, you're not really getting the full scope of what's going on with the patient. So I think that is really important.
It's funny, actually. It reminds me a little bit of school when you sit at the same desk every day, and then there's no sign of seats, but you sit at the same seat, and then you come in that Monday and there's some other kid at your desk, and you're upset for some reason. A lot of ER docs, obviously, especially trauma centers, are the airway, and they stand at the head of that bed. It's almost like you don't want, if you've called anesthesia, to stand there, because that's my spot. I'm supposed to be up there. But how are you supposed to do that? You can't. Seeing someone who is managing an airway trying to run a code is, I mean, if you wanted to just do a checklist on ACLS fallouts, like, you'll see it. I mean, mm-hmm. I've unfortunately had to be in that situation sometimes in certain situations, but I know, for God's sake, I'm like, well, it's been a full minute. I don't know. I give another epi. Like, you can't be objective on terms of that overall patient's care, like, as you said, if you're doing the airway. So,
yeah. So, I mean, and of course, if it's 2 a.m. and you're the only person, then you're the only person. But if you have a team member there that is honestly probably better than you at that thing, let them do that thing and then lead,
be
the leader.
The funny thing about that is, there's a lot of folks that you may not necessarily realize that are in your scope in those emergency situations that are ACLS certified and they can run codes. Mm-hmm. They may not want to, but just, you stand at the head of the bed, I'll get the airway, you run the code.
Yep.
And that's how you got
to be. Quick and easy. Yeah. So just to kind of wrap things up, what are some ways that you think we can communicate better together, work better together, so that we could take the best possible care of these patients, especially these critically ill emergency room patients that come in?
Yeah, I think the most important thing to realize is that empathy amongst coworkers is absolutely vital. We are getting, and it ain't getting any better anytime soon. We already are completely inundated with super sick patients. And it's, you can say whatever social dynamics and aging population and all that, but the point is there's more work now than there ever was and ever will be. And it's going to be busy in infinitum. And it's parsing out any drastic, amazing changes to medicine that occur maybe very much slower than they should. It's going to be that way. And to have that kind of empathy first and foremost is vital. If you are somebody that is really, you know, getting burned out, being able to recognize that is extremely important. And staff and higher ups realizing that staff is getting burned out, that's so important, because a burned out provider, any level, that shrugs even small things. Maybe they don't put away that piece of equipment, or they just mentally can't do it anymore. You know, and then they do those small things, and that leads to someone else that has to do a little bit of extra work. And then that extra person has to, you know, maybe they shrug off even more. It goes downhill to the point where every single person now has to do more work, because tit for tat is the way it works, and whether people know it or not. So from an ER standpoint, if you're calling anesthesia, and you're really burned out, because we are the highest burned out, you know, specialty, you can get into a situation, unfortunately, where it becomes very much an us versus them scenario that is completely in your head. It's completely fake. It's always an us versus, you know, disease. You know, like we're supposed to be fighting the bad diseases that these patients have, right? So that can all be all just in your head. The patients that tend to suffer the most are the sickest, unfortunately, in these kind of scenarios. So that's what you really got to keep in mind. And you can get a reputation, again, if you're calling folks when you may not necessarily need to, of the boy who cried wolf, girl who cried wolf. It may not be something that is, you know, verbally said, but if Dr. such and such is always calling and always this and that, you start to respond a little bit slower. You start to get folks that are specialists that may give a little more resistance. So being mindful of those kinds of things is really important. And if your reason is, well, I want to protect myself medical legally, I'm going to call anesthesia medical, that's not a thing. just like you had alluded to, which is a great point, calling an anesthesia team for backup. And if your reason is legitimately, well, I just want to protect myself, you're not putting that attending in a position where they, you know, are feeling it, real or not, they're feeling that they're not being, that they're being taken advantage of themselves. It's not good medicine. It's not good stewardship. It's not being a good colleague. And the more and more that happens, the worse and worse communication gets, the more and more you silo, and the worse and worse care gets. So that's the idea. The roles should be well established. Who's leading? Who's doing an airway? Who's doing the procedure? And if you're getting burned out, you really need to talk to somebody. You really need to just kind of realize, and it's extremely hard to, because like I'm very much well versed with the chart of the 10 stages of burnout, and I think stage number 4 or whatever is denial. So you know, realizing that you're overworked and you need to just kind of realize where you're at. Got to live life the right way. So that's the recommendations that I'd have.
Something to kind of piggyback off that is that I think more and more people are starting to realize this phenomenon called second victim syndrome. And it happens very often in people that are emergency providers, trauma providers, where you're seeing a lot of really messed up stuff all the time, and really sick people and people that don't have good outcomes. And that wears on people. You know, of course, people have a certain personality to be able to tolerate that a little bit more than others. But eventually you get that one case that just keeps you up at night. And you know, you can, like you said, the burnout. You mentally struggling, you might not intentionally be taking out on the people around you. It changes the culture. So yeah, definitely. I think more and more people are starting to realize, you know, the wellness is an important part of the workplace culture. So to kind of wrap things up, there, you know, I had posted on Instagram for people to send in any questions that they had for you. And, you know, just in the interest of time, we're just going to ask one question that was sent in from Octavia. So Octavia was a former ER nurse, and she had a question regarding hypotension prior to RSI. She wanted to know specifically if there's some kind of algorithm that ER physicians use to kind of mitigate any adverse effects like cardiac arrest after intubation, if the patient's hypotensive prior to. I asked her to give a little bit of backup story to that. So what she had said was, she had a patient that had a history of lung cancer that was in septic shock. The decision was made to intubate this patient, and prior to intubation, the patient was hypotensive. During the intubation, the patient became asystolic and had to be coded, and they weren't able to resuscitate the patient. So the patient ended up passing away. She said that she did work more in a rural hospital environment, but felt like the decision or the way that they treat patients' hemodynamic status was variable, and she felt like maybe it should be more standardized. Thoughts on a case like this and what you do in this situation?
Sure. I think that goes back to one of the points I'd mentioned earlier. Intubation is a license to kill. And this is a perfect example of that. The tough part, and I guess before I even start, I'd say one really good thing that has been shown time and time again that I feel is very rarely practiced is a debriefing after cases such as this. As quote unquote trivial as bad outcomes and deaths and terrible situations are in the ER, a debriefing of what just happened with staff is vital. And it's just not done. And the reason I bring this up just to begin is that in this kind of case, with intubation being a license to kill, we don't actually know if the hypotension was the cause of this patient's cardiac arrest. Were they pre-oxygenated enough? With lung cancer, what kind? Do we know if pulmonary, if they were having pulmonary hemorrhage at the same time? Maybe they were anemic and nobody knew about it. Perhaps they had such a high burden of tumor in the lungs that their pulmonary artery pressures were already through the roof, and that by putting the patient on positive pressure all of a sudden, the hypotension that may have been seen peripherally, maybe it was just a symptom of that. You just shocked that RV so much that it just went into a V-fib and caused death. So I guess as far as standardizing hypotension, it really depends on the attending physician's best guess as to why they're hypotensive. Obviously, septic patients, lung cancer. The thing about sepsis is it's not really a diagnosis in and of itself. I mean, sure, sometimes we're lucky. We kind of know that pneumonia is their cause, or maybe they got a UTI, but we know that it's a distributive shock. So if in a case where maybe it's a little less variables, or let's say in this one particular that we had the sepsis as definitely a diagnosis, they had bounding peripheral pulses, they had bad pneumonia, and they had just so happened to have a history of lung cancer, you should stick to something, especially if they're tachycardic and hypotensive already, that's more peripherally acting, like neosynephrine or something like that. Like, just constrict those vessels temporarily so that we can make sure all the vital organs get all the oxygen and blood flow that they need. And then the steps, just as we'd said, making sure they're as oxygenated as humanly possible. The tough part is, and the frustrating part that Octavia is probably experiencing, is that, knowing, especially if this is a type of case that happens more than once, like, what the heck is going on? Mm-hmm. Why are these providers not treating the hypotension? And not getting the full picture of the case is kind of the key there, is that just because the pressure is low doesn't unfortunately mean that even giving them a med to support their blood pressure temporarily would help. Given the situation, sometimes it can do a lot of harm. So that's the tough part. But if you're lucky enough to know the type of hypotension, then perhaps you can pick an agent that would do it. If you're unfortunately in cardiogenic shock, for example, that's a really tough one, right? Because even if you've got a inotropic agent that you could give, usually they lead to a patient becoming more hypotensive initially to begin with. Additionally, during the intubation, we know that we're changing now from a negative intrathoracic pressure to a positive. So how is that affected? Do they need more volume? Maybe we should volume resuscitate if we can oxygenate and ventilate decently. Maybe the patient's got somewhat of a mental status. Maybe we can give them, maybe if they don't need a lot of, maybe they're already edematous, maybe give them 25 grams of albumin or something beforehand. Give them a lot, good enough volume so that they can overcome that pulmonary pressure. That's the thing. That's why it's not standardized. The tough part is there's definitely no algorithm, unfortunately, with these kind of scenarios in most of the cases, because there's just such a variable population of hypotensive getting intubated patients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all good points. Just keeping in mind that we may not know exactly why this patient coded. It could be a whole host of other reasons why. I know for on the anesthesia team, if we're about to intubate and we maybe suspect that the patient might become severely hypotensive, we do give phenylephrine at the same time as we're giving the etomidate. And of course, those we tend to use a lot more propofol, but in this situation, we would use etomidate or use a very, very, very small amount of propofol. But yeah, all good points. But anyway, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I think this is a really good discussion, and a lot of the people that provide anesthesia or learning anesthesia are definitely going to be interested in hearing an ER physician's perspective on emergency airways, surgical airways, and team dynamics between the ER and anesthesia. If people wanted to reach out to you and ask you additional questions about you and your practice, what's a good way that they can contact you?
I think just email is probably fine. JessMarie@gmail.com is totally fine. I'm sure you could send out to if they needed to. That's totally, I make it a point to try to stay off social media if I can help it.
Yeah, so we'll put that information in the show notes.
Absolutely.
Along with the algorithms that that Gus shared with me. So we'll post the ER algorithms from MCRIT. We'll post the ASA algorithms for the difficult airways in the show notes as well. Awesome. Thank you so much.
The only thing I'll say is if you're doing anesthesia, just always remember that there's way more to this whole medicine treatment of patients than just one thing. Definitely, if you can, get in the ER, see if you can rotate. Hell, see if you can do an airway if you're at that level of training while you're in the emergency room, just to see what's up, because that empathy comes from experience and seeing what your colleagues and what you and unfortunately may end up needing to do in the future. So definitely keep an eye on that if you can as an experience.
Absolutely.